Thanks for tuning into the QSO Today podcast. I'm your host, Eric Guth, 4Z1UG. My QSO today is with Amnon Bar-Giora, 4X1DF. Amnon is a friend and mentor to me in Israel and serves not just as an amateur radio role model, but also as a person who steps up to the plate when needed to serve his country and his fellow man. At 91 years of age, Amnon still travels to conventions, goes on business, meets with his friends, and attends meetings of the Israel Amateur Radio Club, where he is the honorary president. He is a modest man and will tell you that the contributions that he made to the nascent state of Israel were what anyone in his position would have done. He is right, and in that many of his contemporaries here in Israel were also people who stepped up to the plate and played significant roles. Some of these contributions Amnon will be able to recall to us, including some of the operations with the Mossad, Israel's spy agency, where he played a significant role. Other stories may only be told after he has left this world. A side note, you will hear me interrupt Amnon a few times during the interview that I conducted in Amnon's dining room in Tel Aviv. He, like many of us in Israel, use Hebrew words in our English conversation. My interruptions are to help clarify for the listener some of the Hebrew terminology used during the conversation. My apologies to you and Amnon if it may appear rude. And now, Amnon Bar-Giora, 4X1DF. 4X1DF, this is 4Z1UG. Are you there, Amnon?
Yeah, hello. Like...
So I start the show this way, but Amnon and I are sitting at his dining room table. I've driven down to Tel Aviv today to sit with Amnon Bar-Giora, 4X1DF, and to hear about his ham radio journey. So, Amnon, let's start at the very beginning. It's my understanding that you were first licensed in 1946 as ZC7AC. Can you talk about what led you to getting your first ham radio license, and when that was?
This is really not a license, because it was before the State of Israel was founded. So there was the English administration here, and I was a pirate. I didn't get a license. Mm-hmm. We worked here all, most of the radio amateurs in 30, I came to Israel at 38.
In 1938,
I was 15 years old in the kibbutz and in the Aliyat HaNoah. And I was responsible in the kibbutz for the cinema and all kind of electronic equipment, because I was always interested in electronic equipment. So
They recognize your aptitude for electronic devices.
I came from the Haganah, and there was a course, radio operator course in the kibbutz from the Haganah. So I was mobilized by the Haganah for this course, and I learned Morse. This was Morse, and operating procedures for the Haganah. The Haganah had a big operator net in Israel under the English administration, but it was an underground.
Can you explain first who the Haganah were for our audience?
The Haganah was the underground military organization.
That led to the Israeli army.
The beginning of the Israeli army, what then the active part of it was the Palmach. The Palmach was the active fighting units. But the Haganah was the whole organization. And I think I was very good in the Morse. So that I was working in the kibbutz about 1 year. In the Jordan Valley, Beit Zera, there were few stations. In Tiberias was the the central station. Mm-hmm. So I was, I think, very good in Morse, so they took me to Tiberias to operate the regional station there. And then from there they took me to Tel Aviv to the central station of the Haganah, with everything in the underground.
Uh-huh.
And so this was my start think of Morse operation.
Uh-huh.
And how I came to Radio Amateur, in this time we had Australian soldiers were came on vacation to the kibbutz. And there was one guy who was a radio amateur. He saw what I doing, what I'm doing, building some equipment. So we were getting good friends, and we were building together a transmitter.
Do you remember who he was, what his name was?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, that's,
it was a long time ago.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and all this was only 3 weeks in the kibbutz together with him.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very interested in the radio amateur operation. And he gave me the RSGB handbook as he left. I gave him an album of stamps,
uh-huh,
as a present, and he gave me a radio amateur handbook of the RSVB.
What is the organization that made this handbook?
RSVB was the British radio amateur organization.
Uh-huh.
And I was studying the book, and later I was in the Palmach, and later I got a job from Ben Gurion. My meeting with Ben Gurion in Tel Aviv.
Was the first prime minister of
prime
Israel.
Of the Gan.
Uh-huh.
I know everybody knows Ben Gurion.
Uh-huh.
And he asked me if I'm ready to take over, to organize a radio communication between all the settlements in the Upper Galilee. But I must do it in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So I had about 26 settlements from Metula to Genosa. And I got from the Haganah, I got a transmitter which was called Tzabar, which was SSB.
Mm-hmm.
No, yeah, AM. No, it AM. Was AM, yes. And so during 6 months, I was building up a net in the Upper Galilee for 26 settlements. And the reason was that Ben Gurion and the cabinet then were afraid that the Upper Galilee were cut off from Israel by the Syrian military. So they had to have communication. In any case, they were cut off from
Was the Sabar radio, was that manufactured by the
It was manufactured by the Haganah, uh-huh, in the board of the Haganah in Tel Aviv. It was a very small set with a 6L6 tube,
mm-hmm,
metal tube. It was very small, and I have bought 26 radios, normal radios,
mm-hmm,
which they had a shortwave apart, and we were working on 80 meters.
So you'd use a general coverage shortwave receiver with the Sabar transmitter.
Yes, and the transmitter was working on 3-point-something hertz. And so there was a normal radio. It was called Ambassador. It was a British radio. And a small box, black box, for transmitting. So this was the beginning, and then in this time, Ben-Gurion also asked if we are able to make a broadcasting station, because the Haganite broadcasting station here in the vicinity of Tel Aviv, Telem Shamir Boaz was the call of this station. But it was not strong enough because they were moving from one place to the other because they were...
it was a portable station,
Portable broadcast station. Because the British were searching for this station all the time. So I got a transmitter. Built by 2 807 tubes. It were about 100 watt. And I got two people. One was playing on the accordion. It's a very famous guy called the name. And a woman who was the broadcaster, Dana Kogan, very famous woman. She was later in the television. And every morning and afternoon we were transmitting from Ayelet HaShachar in the cow, how do you call it, where the cows... stone.
Oh, from a dairy.
From a refet.
A refet, right. But from a dairy, essentially.
Yeah, but
on the roof.
On the roof of the refet, where all the straw were, and we have built up a studio with this transmitter. We had to make it soundproof because
the cows made noise.
So that was... it must have been sure that the British didn't recognize where the station is. So. And there I have, we had, by the way, a receiver there. And I started to be a pirate with the call sign ZC6AZ. It was the call sign. We made some contacts with Europe and the United States and so on and so on. And this was the beginning. So I have listened a lot to the operating facilities of radio amateur. I heard a lot of stations and how they were working, how they're operating, and so I was able to make some nice contacts from there. So after the war,
in 1948,
we founded the Israel Amateur Radio Club. This was...
it's just like the ARRL for Israel. It was national club.
We were very few, about 10 radio operators. And that was officially acknowledged by the Ministry of Communication. And we got our call signs. Because we are all CW operators. We got all the I got my first license in 1948. Yeah, 1948, the official license 4X4 Delta Fox. And I was in Jerusalem. And I built up my own station, transmitter. Again, I built up a station with 2 807, about 120 watts. And I made quite a lot of experiments.
We can hold for just a second.
Okay. Well, there were, I got a receiver, BC-32, I can't remember, no, exactly. You remember, it was the American military receiver.
Okay.
And that was in Jerusalem, so I started to be a radio amateur. This was really, really licensed radio amateur.
Now, amateur radio, you started the Israel Amateur Radio Club, which is the national organization for ham radio in Israel. There's 10 of you that are getting started. How did you build up the numbers? Because there was a time in Israel when every kibbutz, I think every moshav had a, every community had an amateur radio operator. It seemed like that was, I mean, I remember being here 33 years ago, and you could find an antenna just about.
No, they were not radio amateurs, really not. They were operators, but with the foundation of the State of Israel, the British left, so we started to have normal telephone communication, normal radio as a standby. But it was not really operating like radio amateurs. They were operating like a radio station, communication station. But we were about 10 radio amateurs. And so we started to organize ourselves. And there were joining all the time new radio amateurs. We make courses and we had meetings in Tel Aviv of the first committee. The first head president or head of the club was the 4 Bravo X-Rays, Yoma. And
his call sign again was?
4X-Ray, 4 Bravo X-Ray.
4X4BX.
Yeah, okay. BX.
Uh-huh.
And so we had monthly meetings in Tel Aviv in a cafe. And slowly but surely, we were going to a bigger crowd. I think we had already 100 members of the club.
By about
by what? By about 1952. Something like this. I was in Jerusalem, so I founded the first club in Jerusalem. It was about, I was in the police. I worked after the war of liberation. A good friend of mine, he was the head of the communication in the police. He came to me and asked me if I'm ready to join the police to help him to build up the
radio communication
net of the police. So I said, okay. So I was first the radio officer for the Jerusalem district. We had the stations in Gush Etzion,
where I live.
There was a station in Kfar Etzion. Everything was in Morse then.
Mm-hmm.
There was a station in settlement down there near Jericho.
Mitzpeh Jericho?
No, Mitzpeh Jericho.
Down in the
valley.
Uh-huh.
I had about 3 stations in the Gush Etzion. And then Kiryat Anavim.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with my station in Jerusalem living in the Netorekarta area.
Mm-hmm. So you were actually in the neighborhood called Mea Shearim.
Mea Shearim.
I know it well. My son lives there.
Yeah.
And probably in the building that you were in, you know, most likely.
We were in a normal building and in a shrik. I was operating from Jerusalem for the Haganah, then till the British left. So this was all the communication was in Morse. And I had a very special Morse music.
Uh-huh.
They were recognizing that I am
that it was
the operator, yes. Mm-hmm. I was with working with a straight key.
Mm-hmm.
And then later I found out that there is something like a bug.
Uh-huh.
And I fall in love with the bug.
Uh-huh.
And since then I was working with a bug. By the way, I have
it a Vibroplex bug?
No. I have still the bug here with me. It's the first bug. It's Edison, a British key.
Mm-hmm.
And there I met real music. I walked. Everybody has recognized
Edison. And when you say music, it's your style.
Your
style was recognized over the air. The weight of your dits and dots.
I mean, with a straight key, you can't do it. You have no much choices. But with a buck, you can make really music.
From the CW.
Yeah.
Well, I hope to have a picture of this bug in the show notes page.
Yeah. I have it here, yeah. So, This was my one and a half years I was working in Jerusalem in Migrash HaRusim, and I founded the club, and there were I made a course, the first course from our club.
Mm-hmm.
And the stations there, they are very famous stations. It is 4x4 Delta Kilo,
mm-hmm.
who is the first in the DXCC,
right.
On our own. And 4x4 Delta Charlie, the 4x4 Delta, all these Delta Hotel, he passed away just a few weeks ago. And so there was a group of about 7, 8 radio amateurs. We were meeting in the club. We had the station there. And we made the first field day.
Made the first field day in Israel.
In Israel.
Uh-huh.
In the Ben Shemen forest. We put on a tent. We put a mobile station.
Uh-huh.
So that was the first field day. So, I was working 7 years in the police. We are building up the whole net of the police. I was then appointed to a special job. I had to build up what we call a monitoring stations to monitor all kind of civil operation, radio operation.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the direction finder unit to find out pirates and so on and so on. So, and then I built up the first station for the Interpol.
Interpol is the International the police organization.
We had the station, the center of the Interpol was in Paris. So we had a contact to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And after 7 years, I finished all these jobs. I left the police. And my family and myself, we moved to Ashkelon.
Ashkelon is a seaside city south of Tel Aviv.
Yes. And there I have built up a bigger station, a beam, and so on. And
you had a business also in Ashkelon, did you not?
I built up a factory in Ashkelon, which was called Keren Electronica, which is existing today.
And what did you build there?
We were building special power supplies and amplifiers for the Air Force, 2 meter, 2 meter amplifiers. But then I was called by the Haganah. It was then not anymore Haganah. It was
now the IDF.
Before the IDF. And I was asked if I'm ready to go to Egypt. It's still on 42, 43 before this.
So you're still during World War II.
I go back nowhere.
Okay.
If I'm ready to go to Egypt to teach Yugoslav partisans, Morse. So I went to the to Egypt. This was the place is the.
You went as a British soldier, right?
British soldier. I was a sergeant, but undercover.
Right.
Not with my name. And
but your primary role was you were a British soldier in the Jewish unit, right? That went
not in the Jewish unit.
Oh, just as a.
And it was the intelligence service of the Royal Air Force.
Okay.
That was in Castle Neil Barracks in Cairo. It was the headquarters. And there were all the partisans from many countries, also our Israeli Jewish partisans, Chaviva Reich, Hanna Senesh, Anzio Sireni.
These are all huge names in the history of.
And there were, I went to Europe, but the headquarters of all these operations have been in Cairo. So I had a group of Yugoslavs. Partisans, they were under the command of General Mihailovic, which was the opponent of Tito. So I made this course, and after this I went back to Israel, was working in the headquarters of the Haganah. It was before the State of Israel, so I jumped back a little bit.
Yes, that's okay.
Okay. Now, okay. Then I was operating as a normal radio amateur here from Ashkelon.
So we're back in the mid-50s now.
Yeah.
Right? And this is when you're in Ashkelon?
Yeah, yeah. And
can you speak about the other services that you provided to the State of Israel? Or can you do that now? Or
I was...
Because I see you have some other call signs, former call signs, like DK9IE and ET3AZ.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, can you speak about how you came about having those call signs?
There, in this time, in Germany, I was working as Delta Kilo 9 India Echo at the station there at home. I was in the village. But for your question. So I was operating under the call sign Delta Kilo 9 India Echo.
Do you want to talk at all, or can you speak at all about what you did with the Mossad in Ethiopia or anything like
that? Yeah, okay. Then,
you don't have to. I just
No. I will tell you. I was no. With the time, it's not a little bit confusing because I jumped.
You jumped way ahead.
But I have to go back a little bit.
If we go back into the late 50s, right, early 60s.
No, I left the police. 62.
So in 1962.
62. And then I was still here in Israel, not in Germany. I was asked if I'm ready to go for 4 months to some special operation. They need me.
This is Ben-Gurion again tapping your shoulder and asking you to serve your country.
So, and I went to Tel Aviv, to the Mossad, and I said, okay, and we decided with my partners in the factory for months, okay, to do something for the state of Israel. After all what we already have done in the Palmach and all the other operations. I said, okay. And I went to Ethiopia. This operation was in Ethiopia. But I was 4 months, they told me 4 months, but I couldn't leave this job in Ethiopia. So I was 4 years.
So the 4 months turned into 4 years in
over
Ethiopia.
Over 4 years, four and a half years.
And did your family go with you?
No.
So they stayed in Israel.
There, yeah. So after 4.5 years, I was operating in Ethiopia as ET3AZ with a BC610 transmitter, it was 1 kilowatt. And after these 4.5 years, I came back, and then I was 3.5 years in Germany. And then 1 year in France. And in 1974.
Can I ask you a question? Can you say who you worked with in Ethiopia, or do we have to, we're going to have to wait until, wait for another 20 years before?
No, in Ethiopia, there were actually two levels. One, I can't talk about it. And one, officially, I was responsible for the security of Haile Selassie.
It was the
king.
The king of Ethiopia.
Yeah. And
Was there a radio role in that responsibility?
Yes. I was a radio. I built up a radio station because he was traveling on state visits, not in the country, all Africa, all the world. We were in Brazil. I was in Brazil with him, and I was in all African countries. So we had the communication to Addis Ababa
Uh-huh.
And in this time in Ethiopia, one day I have been told by the king that Dag Hammarskjöld, the secretary of the UNO, and Dag Hammarskjöld, and was the second guy, American guy, is coming to Addis, and there was the revolution in Congo.
Mm-hmm.
So the United Nations took over to send military people to the Congo, and this military people have been Ethiopian army. Dag Hammarskjöld came to Addis, talked with him, and he asked if I'm able to organize communication in Congo for the United Nations, for the Ethiopian troops. So I was sent to Elizabethville, then today it's another name, and I got from the United Nations 19 sets. If you know the 19 sets?
No.
19 sets have been transceivers built into tanks. Very, very good equipment.
Tank radios.
Tanks.
And where were they made?
Partly in the States, partly in England.
I see.
So I got about 20 units, and I built up a net in Congo. Yes, it was about half a year in this operation. Yeah, I finished my job in Ethiopia, and then I was in Germany, I was in France, then I came back to Israel. I was in Israel here sometime. And in the year 74, I went out on pension.
Mm-hmm.
Very young. So
a young pensioner.
Yeah, very young pensioner.
Can you speak at all about what you did in South America?
Yeah, okay. South America is a completely different story.
Well, you're a man with many stories.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm speaking to a 91 and a half year old Amnon.
Yeah.
Here. So Amnon has a life of stories.
Yeah, okay. Again, my good friends came and told me, need you. Mm-hmm. They say, okay, what is the matter now? So this was after Operation Eichmann.
All right, after so we're back to 1961, 1962.
Yeah, something like this, mm-hmm. Yes. But Eichmann was...
So the Nazi Eichmann,
yeah,
had just been picked up by the most... He had been kidnapped by the Mossad in Buenos Aires,
yeah, but,
and returned to Israel.
Yeah, but there was a second guy... To capture, it was Mengele, Dr.
Okay.
Mengele.
Josef Mengele was the famous
doctor in Auschwitz.
Right.
So.
I'm inserting a comment here, since the operation that Amnon will describe in as little detail as befits his personality was a massive operation that included the kidnap of Adolf Eichmann, the author of the Nazi Final Solution for the Extermination of Jews in Europe during World War II. Eichmann was living in Buenos Aires and was easily captured by the Mossad and returned to Israel for trial. Amnon was on the team that was to locate Josef Mengele, the doctor of Auschwitz who made the final selection at the railroad platform at Auschwitz, where Jews from Europe were divided to live and work as slaves in the camps or to die immediately in the gas chambers of Auschwitz. He was also conducting horrific experiments on Jews, especially twins, that defy the imagination. It was important to the Prime Minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, that Mengele be captured and returned for trial. Amnon spent 6 months in South America and about 2 months in Paraguay, where he located Mengele. The operation was called off by Ben-Gurion because there was no way to extract Mengele without a large loss of the Mossad team. Mengele later died in a mysterious drowning accident.
I agreed. And I went to Argentine and then later to Paraguay to find
him.
Yes. But it was a mission impossible to kidnap him. He was in a place where, in the jungle in Paraguay, and there are no roads, no airport, nothing. It was somewhere at the end of the world.
Right.
So you could. And after a few months in Paraguay was very, very difficult. It was a very, very tough place. It was a dictator, General Stroessner.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't move freely in Paraguay. So all this story is in my book.
Right.
And there I was not operating. I went back to Switzerland because I was asked by a big company in Germany if I ready to operate a company, financial company in Switzerland. I took this job.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky. After I finished this job, this was 1 year, I was able to build my own company in Switzerland. So I was in Switzerland, living in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a call sign, Hotel Bravo 9, Juliet Alpha India. And I was operating again, mm-hmm. normally, as a radio amateur.
Do you obviously you've been in Israel since the very beginning of amateur radio. You were a founder of amateur radio for all intent purposes in Israel. Do you have advice for amateur radio operators who are either new to the hobby or are returning to the hobby after maybe taking a vacation from the hobby to raise children? That was my story. Do you have some advice for new hams?
Yeah, first of all, there are different parts in each life.
Mm-hmm.
If you are starting to build up a family, then you are busy with the children. So you have not very much time left to have a radio mode. So I think there are more or less, I can give advice to start early, if you are in school.
Mm-hmm.
After school, you have an interval because you go to the army, and then you can't operate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here in Israel, after high school, all the kids go to the army.
Yeah, right. And then no operation.
Before
possible.
University.
Yeah.
Right.
And after the army, not all radio amateurs starting again.
Mm-hmm.
They're living the hobby, but in principle, after you finish army and you are released from the army, then you can again operate. I would say very important is to study, to learn all the possibilities this hobby is giving you. It's not only to making contacts.
Mm-hmm.
You have quite a lot of possibilities in this radio amateur. You can join expeditions.
The expeditions.
Yeah.
Right.
I have done two in my life. I've organized two. You have SSTV. You have a lot of possibilities, activities you can activize.
Mm-hmm.
So my advice is to learn, to study what are the possibilities mm-hmm. this hobby is giving you.
Sample as many as possible.
There's a lot, right. A lot. You have all the digital communication, you have, as I said, SSTV, you have emergency networks, a lot. The sky is the limit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to learn. to study all the time all the new the inventions and so on and so on. Then you find out that it's a very fantastic hobby with a lot of activities and friendships. I have a lot of friends all over the world, and you have congresses, you have organizations.
Conventions, yeah. Right?
So it's important to be on the ball, not to take it as a, like Facebook or something, communication,
mm-hmm.
To study, to learn, to be interested in the whole organization. This is very important, because if you're making only commercial today, okay, younger people are fed up with the internet. A lot of young people are not living Facebook and all this.
I think one of the reasons for the major growth of ham radio in North America is that with Hurricane Katrina and some of the natural disasters, they've discovered that the internet on all these mobile infrastructures that we have are very fragile.
Yeah.
They're amazing when they work, but it doesn't take a whole lot for them to stop working.
Yeah.
So as an alternative to Facebook, or an alternative to the internet, amateur radio seems to be more ruggedized, more rugged. We'll survive the
It's a very different hobby, because if you are on the internet, actually, you're operating point to point without knowing how
you got there,
how you communicate with the other part. Skype, for example, it's a beautiful mode, but you don't know how the contact is established between you and the other people you're talking with.
Mm-hmm.
But radio amateur, you're making your own decisions, which frequency and which time of the day,
mm-hmm.
and you have to know knowledge. You have to have a knowledge how to operate and how to make contact between one point to the other. So it's a big difference. People are always telling me, younger people, yeah, you're perfectly right. I must learn, I must know how to make contact now to Australia, if conditions are there, how, which time of the day,
mm-hmm.
and
which frequency band, which antenna,
and how antenna, mm-hmm. and you built your own. You might experiment. I have done a lot of experiments with antennas. My knowledge on antennas is very, very big. I've done a lot of very interesting antennas I built myself,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So you have a lot of things you can do with this hobby.
What rig do you operate right now? What's your rig?
My rig is now the Fox Yeso, Fox Tango DX5000.
Okay, and
which is I would say the ultimate transceiver today.
The ultimate transceiver.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I work with a very old, very, very old amplifier.
Uh-huh.
Which is a Drake L4B.
Wow.
Drake company.
I remember. And so, what mode, and your, of course, your favorite mode is?
It's CW.
CW.
Yeah.
And how fast do you go on CW?
Not as fast as I was. but I work quite fast.
30, 40 words a minute?
Something like this. Uh-huh. Yes. And usually I could read without writing. I was reading the most without writing down.
Right. Uh-huh.
Today it's difficult for me.
And when you travel with a QRP rig, don't you?
Yes, I have a K1.
So you have an Elecraft K1.
Elecraft K1 with two frequencies. It's a very small set. And I have a special antenna which I take with me if I travel. And I'm working also on 2 meter, also on 70 centimeter. I have, you know my station.
I do know your station, but the listeners don't know your station. Anyway, I'll have pictures of the Amnon station in the show notes as well.
And my life was always connected to communication. If I have told you all these stories now, I haven't told you all my stories.
Well, I'm
was always connected to communication.
You're the chairman of the Israel Amateur Radio Club.
Already 6 years now, and yesterday I have regards from our chairman. I was on Friday was a meeting. We have every Friday meeting here, and we have 30 people have been here on last Friday, and the chairman give best regards to you. I told him that you are here on Sunday.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Anyway, it's always my pleasure to come and speak with you, and I thank you.
That's interesting. It was a pleasure always. Next time, bring Karin with you.
For sure. With that, 73.
Well, that wraps up our interview. Please note that after the end of the show, there is another 20 minutes of audio from my interview with Amnon, where he speaks of some commercial ventures that put him in some very interesting world capitals. I put this part of our conversation at the end because it does not relate much to ham radio, but it was a significant episode in Amnon's life and may interest you. Please visit the show notes page for this interview and any of the earlier interviews at www.qsotoday.com. You can use the search box in the upper right corner and search on my guest call sign to find the episode that you want. If you are a new listener, I encourage you to go back to our earliest podcasts and start from the beginning. Keep in mind that we are in the iTunes store and are distributed in podcast format on Stitcher, where all of the episodes are available. I welcome your feedback and input. There are a few ways to do this. You can leave a comment on the show notes page under the guest interview. This is a great way to engage our guest, and he'll reply to you directly. If you sign up for our QSO Today community, I will put you on the QSO Today email list. I promise not to spam you or send your email to anyone. Finally, if you join our community, you will have an access to the community through our closed Facebook group. The Facebook group is an ideal setting to discuss the issues raised by our guests, to discuss or suggest future guests, and to provide feedback on the show and its production. That's all for now. 73 from me, Eric, 4Z1UG. This is where the bonus section begins. At the beginning, Amnon refers to the American test. What that means is Americans take multiple choice tests, and this was unusual to Israelis.
You know what is the American examinations? A questionnaire. And you have a question. It's a multiple choice examination. I was astonished that the American working with such a system, because it was a lot of work. You have hundreds or thousands of questionnaires in all the universities, and then you have a shablon,
right?
And the teacher had to look where were the answers and how many answers are good and how many are bad, and then he passed not. I say, well, it was a fantastic operation, fantastic work. I say that.
I mean, having all of these tests that have to be hand graded by looking for, you know,
yeah,
whether
which
question was marked.
Manual work. It was unbelievable. So I invented a computer. You can imagine a computer in time where there were no microprocessors, mm-hmm. and there were no memories like today. And I built up a system with Holleried cards, IBM Holleried cards, you know, you remember?
Right, I remember a form called the Scantron form.
It looked like a card,
and you...
And there were numbers here, and you had four or five squares.
Bubbles. Right.
And with this Holleried cards, you got the questionnaire, mm-hmm. but you didn't write on the questionnaire your answer. You made
use a number three pencil
of answers right. on the Holleried card.
That's right.
With pencil.
That's right.
With pencil.
I remember it.
And then you put this card in my computer, and if the answer was okay, the weather thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer was wrong, it was making a hole.
Where the correct
punch
answer should
a hole
be.
In it. Mm-hmm. So you had the card with the answers. And at the end, you could make one question 5 points or 4 points and so on. And then the computer was counting how many points you have done right,
mm-hmm.
and giving at the end
the final
score. Punch on yes or no,
mm-hmm.
you are passed or not. So this computer, I was working on it in Ashkelon, and there was a big exhibition here, electronic exhibition in Tel Aviv, and I put my computer on a stand there, and there on the stand there were quite a lot of people from outside, from all over the world, and there came a guy from Germany, and I seen it, and then said, if I'm interested in a partner,
mm-hmm.
to build up a factory. I said, yes, I have a plan to build up a factory in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But we had one of the wars, I don't remember if that was the Six-Day War, but can't remember now. And so we couldn't build up the factory here. It was very difficult. It was a very difficult time.
Right.
So he said, "You come to Germany. Come, I have a small factory. Come to Germany, and we will build up a factory for these computers." And I had a very good friend in the States. He was in Texas Instruments working in Dallas. In Texas. So I told him, okay, I will check now what are the possibilities to sell it, first of all, for the States. So I went to the States, I met my friend there, and we went to Washington to the education.
Mm-hmm. The Department of Education.
The Department of Education. And they were so impressed that they ordered 10,000 units. We got an order for 10,000 units.
Wow.
So my friend in the state, Cliff, in Dallas, we made the office in the States. He was responsible, and he took over also the guarantee and the repair. So But we had no factory.
So you pre-sold 10,000 units before you had a factory.
We have two units for sewing. So my friend in Germany, we built up a very quick factory in Germany, near Heidelberg. And we took some very good engineers, people, and starting to produce and to send to the States. So it was really very good business. And after we have dispatched about 3,000 units, we got a telex from the Ministry of Department of Education to stop sending units because they have no budget.
So they made an order for 10,000 units and then they reneged
on that. After 3,000, they stopped. They say we can sue them, make a court case if you like, but go to make a court
to the American government.
So we were stuck with about 1,000 units. Then something very funny happened. I had a very good friend in Tehran, in Iran. He phoned me and told me, Abdul, please come immediately to Tehran. We have some project here and you could sell your computers. What was the reason? The Shah gave an order to make driving license. In Iran, there were no driving license. You could drive without the license.
So the Shah was making order of chaos in 1974 with drivers. He was going to license drivers. And this is before the Iranian Revolution. I think 79 was the revolution.
I was there. I went there. 74, I went to Tehran. And I met the traffic police. And they were helpless. They didn't know what to do with the examination. There are 80 million people, so at least, let me say, 40 million people have to pass the examinations, how to do it. They didn't know what to do. So I showed them my computer with the Hollerith card and so. And they say, this is the solution. And then the active driving, they're made in some compounds. And they say, okay, we are buying from you as much as units as we need here to make this examinations, under one condition, that you are staying here 1 year.
So you spent a year in Tehran?
No, I spent much more. So again, I went with my wife to Tehran, and I built up in all the big cities. The computer was, there were big halls.
Right.
Several hundred people were sitting. They have this questionnaire, put the sign on the Hollerith cards.
Right.
And then they went to the place where my computer standing, they put the card in, and if it was okay, then he could go out to the office and he got his driving license. If it was bad, then he had to wait 3 months
to take the test again. And did you build these units, you built them in the factory in Germany, or did you end up building them in Tehran?
In Germany. Built up a.
You know how many units you sold into Iran?
I think we had built about 200, something like this. And I wasn't there, and I had not very much work to do because always if there was a problem, so they asked me to come to the police. And I was with my wife there.
And did you operate ham radio from Iran?
No. There, this was this 3.5 years. I was not operating.
Wow, feast or famine, right? You can be here and you can operate all you want, and you go to Iran and you couldn't operate at all.
Yeah, but I was very busy there, and Iran was full of projects. Full. There were a lot of Israeli guys there building up a factory. Motorola factory was built up by Israelis, and a lot, unbelievable what happened
industry,
there.
Right.
Bell helicopter factory was built up there.
Because it was an outpost of the West. I mean.
But I have decided I'm founding a company there to make some projects. To make some money. So I took as a partner one of the sons of one very famous Ayatollah. There's Ayatollah Behbahani. He made the revolution against Mossadegh. It was General Mossadegh who all the revolutions in Iran, always military ayatollahs, military ayatollahs. Hassan shel Ayatollah Behbahani, Kamal Behbahani, was my partner. So the first project was built up a factory, an oxygen factory. You know, there are big bottles of oxygen bottles. For hospitals and for so a German company built up for us this factory, and I made all kind of business in education and so on and so on. And then there was a big tender, you know.
A request for bid
from the oil company. For 250 houses. And I had very good friends in Denmark for prefabricated houses. I built up one house in Tehran, and we made 7 houses in a factory in Ahvaz. Very beautiful houses. And then I have no experience with houses. I made some trial. So I had this one building in Tehran. I could show it to everybody. And then was a bid from the oil company for 250 houses, a big, big project with all the roads and really a very big project. And I don't know why. There were a lot of big companies in Iran that were operating there. I got a tender
to build the 250 houses.
Yes.
Wow. Well, those were the days.
And so we were really surprised. We were really a small company. But okay, my partner, he was in big contacts and so on and so on. So I was in Abadan, oil company. I went back. I were preparing the bid, all the details as well. A lot of work. I went back to Tehran, and I was meeting my friend, the ambassador, the Israeli ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
So he told me, I have understood you have got a bid for the oil company. I said, yes. Don't sign the contract. He told me, don't sign the contract. Say, why, what happened? Close down your company, take out the money from the bank, take your wife, and leave Tehran as quick as possible. He said, we are telling the Americans all the time, here will be a revolution in a very short time.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't believe. They don't believe.
So the Israelis had intelligence that there was going to be a revolution in Iran.
Khomeini was prepared by this. So they prepared Khomeini, the French.
Right. Oh, he was in France, right.
He was in France. And they thought, if we have Khomeini, then we can do all the big projects. They were very mistaken. So, cut.
Well, because Khomeini, as we know from history, the revolution came, Khomeini came into power, and the doors to the West closed.
Exactly.
Right.
So I talked with my wife, say, look, this is what Uri telling me, what we are going to do. I closed the company, took
your money,
and left. It was very difficult to explain to my partner, Kamal Bevani, why I'm running away.
Mm-hmm.
Later, I met him in Frankfurt, and he said, oh.
He knew exactly.
Absolutely.
This concludes Amnon's story, and as everyone knows, the Ayatollah Khomeini, a few months later, came into Tehran, and Iran closed to the West, and is still in a state of turmoil, even now. So, thanks for listening.